Hey everyone, it's time to kick off another exciting session of our DevOps Office Hours. It's May 24th, 2023. My name's Eric Osterman and I'll be your host. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse helps teams conquer AWS using our rock solid blueprints. If you are starting from scratch or just not satisfied with your current setup, book a session with me by going to cloudposse.com/quiz. Answer a few quick questions, and I'll show you exactly why your team will succeed using our blueprint. For those of you new to the call, don't worry. Our format is super informal. My goal is to answer your questions. If you're curious about Cloud Posse or any of our open source tools and modules, this is a great place to ask. For those of you joining through our podcast or YouTube channel, we host these calls every week, so don't miss out. You can register for these live and interactive sessions by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, that's cloudposse.com/officehours. Our call today is recorded. We'll post a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So if you want to help and support what we do over here, please hit those like and subscribe buttons. It helps us out a great deal. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. Also, don't forget, you can share these videos with your team if you found something interesting on our call today. It's a great way to get everybody on your team on the same page. You'll find that this recording there as well as past sessions as well with full text transcripts and all that stuff. So with that said, let's jump into the actual announcements. So some of the news going on. All right, so one that I was excited about because I didn't trust using any of the other like 1,000 copycat GPT apps out there claiming to be the GPT app. So now there's an official one by OpenAI. You can try it out. Still pretty bare bones, not much more than what you have on the website. I was a little bit bummed by this, that they didn't enable it for the App Store. It's only available in the mobile App Store. Is this one here? Who brought it to my attention? I think it was maybe Jeremy White on our team. This is pretty bad. There's a new .zip TLD by the Google registrar. And Google is pretty on top of these things, right? Like they have pioneered a lot of the science around phishing or thwarting phishing attacks based on all their experience managing Google Workspaces and Gmail and so forth. But this one, how did this one get passed? So this one here, it's pretty non-obvious for anybody who isn't very particular with how URIs are parsed by browsers and by CLIs. And in this case here, this looks like a totally normal URL that you've seen 1,000 times, both of these. The at sign here, though, that's saying that everything in front of it is actually a username and password for basic auth. So in this case, somebody can purchase, a domain like v1271.zip and easily trick someone into clicking on that link and serving off a payload. Anyone have more commentary on this one?
I think Vlad mentioned it, but they also, I noticed it before too. Someone actually bought attachment.zip and go ahead and browse to it and you'll see what happens.
I don't know if I should.
Don't worry. Nothing's going to get stolen.
It's safe for work.
No, it's safe for work. Yes.
Yeah. Nice.
Oh, you're not sharing that window though.
Oh, okay, right. I opened up a Cognito one. Yeah. So I was oops.
Well, yeah. That's what happens.
Yeah, it sends you to ritual. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
We didn't laugh, but the concept of ritual rolling has taught a lot of people to be very, very wary and suspicious of links because they might get recalled. Like that had a big impact on teaching people about security on the internet.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful for the Good Samaritans that took that one out of circulation. We'll wait for the next one. Attachments.zip, coming to a Fisher near you.
Yeah.
All right. Next. Next one. This was something caught my eye. I haven't tried it out or anything. Curious if anyone here has. It stands out to me kind of in the same way why Obsidian stands out. Like a browser designed for developers, for engineers, that's fully programmable and more extensible than your typical Chrome browser.
As somebody that spent a lot of time using Surf and USDL and other fancy, not fancy, but hacker browsers while I was running Linux, I very rarely program my browser. What I actually care about is accessing websites and those websites working. And that's not always a thing with exotic browsers. Like, nice. This is awesome from a hacker perspective and for the nerdy part of it, but that's it.
Jump to
headers and stuff, like, yeah, awesome. And then you see how many websites don't actually use headers and just use some weird form of div instead of headers because reasons. It's the internet is, a lot of hackers assume the internet is conforming to the spec and using compliant HTML and semantic HTML and all the relevant tags. And that's just not it. And when I actually, like, if I'm doing this to relax, sure. But I use my browser to work and I need it to actually show the information and enable me to work. I don't need it to have an API and other stuff like that. Like, yeah, that is cool and helpful, but that's not.
Yeah, if they want this project to be a success, they'd have to make it a browser that's based on Chrome or Firefox. Like Brave is based on Chrome, Tor browser is based on Firefox. All the ones that have done something that get adoption, they base it on a browser that actually isn't wide support of websites. So I don't know. Maybe underneath they did use one of the existing engines. If they did, then they won't have any problem being compatible.
Yeah. Doesn't immediately say what's under the hood. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for
that. I still use W3M at the command line sometimes, so I'm crazy, but
awesome.
And they're helpful. Like, don't get us wrong. I use W3 and other text-only browsers to download web pages, like only the text version. But that's a very out there use case.
Yeah, few and far between.
And it doesn't always work. And it really annoys me when I thought I saved the web page. And it's actually like only half of the page, only part of it, because the other part was hidden behind some weird div and stuff.
Yeah. The next one, Jeremy White shared this one with me. This was yet another collaborative editor. There's so many of these, and it surprises me that there's yet, you know, that people work on yet another one, kind of like Gmail mobile clients or task management systems. There's a million. What I thought was interesting is like they're really, you know, highlighting this thing on performance. And Is everyone frustrated with the speed of VS Code and some of the conventional options out there? Because to me, that wasn't something I was thinking of.
If you're opening, I feel like I'm talking too much. If you're opening up big files, yes, like VS Code is, try opening up a CSV of a couple megs. VS Code is going to be so much slower than Sublime Text. Like the difference is massive, and finding something in that CSV, or maybe it's not the CSV, maybe it's a really big JSON. The difference is very much there in the interface. Like you do feel it. In regards specifically to Zed, I tried it. It is indeed fast, it's also a beta or an alpha beta. So don't expect too much from it. It didn't have enough plugins for me and for what I was doing, but I really like the focus on performance and on it being fast. I hate it when I program and I hit some keyboard shortcuts to do something and the actual UI doesn't move fast enough. And like the fifth step in the chain of shortcuts is actually move to another window or something like that. And it does something completely different that I have to change. So I like it. I've tried it. It's nice. I know some people that are using it full time for TypeScript development and they seem to be happy. It wasn't a fit for what I was doing. I was doing Python and web dev. By web dev, I mean HTML and CSS.
Isn't it almost inevitable that as any one of these platforms get all the plugins, get all the flexibility, that they all suffer the same fate? Kind of like Chrome used to be the fastest browser and, you know, then it got really powerful.
Not really, because, and I think Zed has a blog post about this, about how they're doing it in the background and on a different thread and process from the actual stuff that's controlling the UI. So a plugin being slow will not actually impact your code editing or anything like that.
I mean, I don't know that I can agree with that, because that's actually what VS Code does too. It starts all the language servers as their own background processes and it uses RPC to communicate with them. And that's the thing that is slow in VS Code. It's like when you open that giant JSON file, whatever you have that is selected to format JSON documents and, you know, read them and do schema validation and all that kind of stuff is probably the thing that's slowing the editor down, and not the actual editor itself would be my guess. But I guess we would have to, we'd have to add in some sort of, like, you know, process debugging to figure that out. But
that's definitely the case. VS Code had people are using VS Code, they're using tons of plugins. Hell is true for VI. I'm still a VI user. So VI is, or Vim, is super fast, but you can add, if you add SPF 13 and all these other VI plugins, it suddenly becomes slow. So the question is, can they add all these features? Can they add all the features and still keep it fast? Depends how they're writing the code. If they want to have community contribution to plugins, it's going to go slow. No way around that.
I also don't think it supports Terraform. it's like a really
at the community extension. The community extension is not going to focus as much on performance. So there you go.
That's because if they loaded Terraform, it would be slow.
If it helps, I'm doing Nova with the with Terraform, and I'm happy with it.
All right. Well, I'm just going to check one thing here quickly. Did anyone? I'm just curious. Did anyone join through the registration link today? Just because I only see 13 people here, and sometimes that means that there's some problem with our registration page.
I joined with the link that was in the calendar. It showed that it was waiting for the host to start the meeting. I assumed that was Zoom being weird, so I exited and clicked the same link again and just put me here. So it might be a Zoom quirk.
Yeah, maybe some Zoom quirk. All right. Let's see, the next announcement is, thanks Vlad for the feedback. Next announcement was a cool little concept for a laptop. Apparently they're producing it. It is a VR centric laptop. Looks, I don't know, I think they gotta work on the design a little bit. Doesn't look cool to me, but conceptually I like the idea. So instead of a screen, you have a set of VR goggles, so you can have a 100-foot screen in front of you and total privacy. I wasn't entirely sure the maturity of development and where it is, if it's like a Kickstarter or actually in full production, but has anyone looked at this further?
Don't believe this bullshit. It's really annoying that the VR industry keeps pushing this because it's very, very, very misleading. There have been a lot. Okay, I know this because I work with some VCs that are investing in VR stuff, and I got to see a bunch of really fancy outdoor demos. I'm not leaking anything in the air here. But yes, VR has improved a lot. Less people get now motion sickness or get sick if they have VR headset for more than half an hour on. Like, that has improved a lot. It's not perfect, but it's still there. But the resolution is still really, really small. Like, yeah, you get up 1080p at 72 feet or whatever it is. Awesome. You have 10 DPI. My God, text is going to look so good. It's utterly and completely useless. And
that is still the
projects
case.
Like this, pushing, this is awesome. Try to use this. It's just making the whole VR stuff, it's pushing VR back. Because people will spend money on this. They will try it and they will see just how bad it is. It annoys me to no end.
Yeah, I did look at it because I was curious about the, I guess, the portability aspect of it. When I'm at home, I've got, you know, three or more monitors and I've got a lot of desktop space or, you know, to work on stuff. But then when I travel, if I'm just traveling with my laptop and I don't have another monitor to connect to, then that's kind of a bummer. And I see this as a possibility, a way to have a common sort of workspace, no matter where I'm sitting. The downside for me though, is the price tag. It's about $2,000 from at least the information that I found. And I'm not guaranteed that this device is going to have the same capabilities that my MacBook Pro has, you know, with all the RAM that's on it, the software that's installed, et cetera, et cetera. So if I could get this capability on my MacBook, then yeah, I'm sold, but I'm not sold on a single device that can do everything. Cause I mean, again, like what if I'm Mac and it's Windows based, or what if I'm Windows and it's Mac based, or whatever the case is. So
that's a good
point. It's got to have a little bit more compatibility and horsepower for me at that price point.
They're taking over too much. It's not just a laptop, load your own operating system. I didn't realize that part, that it's actually, I guess, requires working on this Android operating system. And that's just not how developers are working. So too opinionated on that.
If I was surfing the web, yeah, great. But you know, I've got local apps that I run as well. So
yeah. All right, that's good.
I think I saw somewhere that Apple said that their new like VR headset that they're going to release is going to be compatible with like Apple computers, and that you could use that as like an AirPlay destination or something like that. I don't remember if that was
those are rumors. They made no public statement, but also,
that's what I was about to say.
The rumors are saying that it's gonna be two M2 Pros as CPUs to drive that. So just realize how much computing power that is. Versus, oh, it's a customer processor that's running Android. Like, yeah, cool. And not to dismiss that, because I'm being too mean. I'm sorry. You can do a lot of stuff with like Git pod and code spaces, and you just need a tiny bit of processing to actually show it there. But then you still hit that screen with terrible DPI, motion sickness, getting queasy, and all that stuff. It's not there. I want it to be there, but it's not. And marketing like this is lying to customers. And I find that offending.
Yeah, glossing over some significant details, perhaps. All right. The next one, it's not really an announcement. It was an announcement for me because I missed it somehow. And precisely 1 year ago today, tilt.dev was acquired by Docker. I missed that. So I guess they have by now incorporated a lot of that into it. Also, I noticed that they're heavily promoting now telepresence, even changing their logo around that. So emphasizing telepresence for local development of Kubernetes apps. Was telepresence part of tilt.dev, or was that a separate company? I remember that was another open source project. All right. This one resonated with me. My 20-year career is technical debt or deprecated. Anyone who's been, you know, working at this for a long time, you know, has probably seen much of what they've built deprecated at some point. It's inevitable. The frameworks change, the languages of du jour change, the tooling changes. I'm just waiting for, you know, Terraform to go the way of Chef or Puppet or something. And we all know Flash.
I had one comment on that, though. I feel like there's security in deprecated technologies, oddly enough. I've gotten contract opportunities where, you know, people have had this old ass software up and running and it needs a change, a tweak or whatever, and they can't find anybody anywhere that knows how to fix it.
But the king of that, the king of that is COBOL. People are still writing.
Yeah, exactly. Mine was like load sharing LSF, like running load shared workloads on network computers. And you know, it's like they can't find anybody to fix it. But hey, I just, because I have this bullet on my resume from like three or four jobs back, like 10 years ago, you know, I got a contract opportunity out of it. So I feel like the more old crap that you know, the better suited you are to, you know, kind of cash in on it 20, 30 years down the road.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, yeah, the technology's changed, but so the core engineering principles and design principles haven't changed that much, right? Like you mentioned Puppet, right? You know, you're organizing files and variables and stuff like that. Was it that much different than the Kubernetes stuff you're doing now? You know, when you think about it, it's not really. So that experience, you know, I found that scaffolding from that experience is beneficial as well. That was it. Sorry.
Matt, were you going to say something too? Or
I was just going to say that back in the Y2K timeframe, I was running a division for a company that was doing a ton of Y2K remediation for our customers. And we ended up, along these lines, we ended up starting two new locations, one in Florida and one in Arizona, where we hired as many part-time COBOL programmers as we could find to remediate all the stuff. And I know someone mentioned that. And it was funny because the only people we could find who were doing it, and that's way back then, were like retirees who only wanted to work like a max of like 10 or 15 hours a week. So we had these shifts of just like people who were working 10 or 15 hours to do COBOL remediation. And Arizona and Florida were the locations we picked, obviously, because there's huge retirement communities in both of those locations. So yeah, it's
I experienced the exact same thing. Not the same scale. I just had one guy for the city I was working for that we hired to
yeah.
I did not want to write COBOL, so we hired him and let him do it.
Yeah, I think we had like 300 or 400 people in each location. It was crazy.
Wow. That's funny. I also worked at a Y2K company. Literally like closed their doors, you know, a few weeks after Y2K, and that was it. That was the run. This was interesting. It was via Awesome Terraform. It's a profiler to help you understand where time is spent on your Terraform applies. I haven't looked into exactly how it accomplishes it. It looks like it consumes the log file produced by Terraform. And it can tell you some stats about, you know, how many operations were performed. It doesn't seem like it's able to say exactly like how long all of the create operations took. But hey, better than...
Oh, related. Sorry to interrupt. Eric, yeah. Did you see the old proof of concept for Terraform tracing?
No.
give me a moment to find the link.
Cool. Yeah, bring that up.
So I am terrible at searching. So Agent Steel is an amazing human that is doing a bunch of things. I posted the Twitter link in the Zoom chat, and I'm posting it on Slack right now. So Agent Steel is recently became an AWS hero. He has been doing awesome stuff for a while, and just got cranky and built tracing for Terraform. And he, like, this was just a teaser screenshot on Twitter. He's gonna write it up and PR and open source it. Wow. Again, this is super, super early. We don't know if it's gonna get accepted or anything, but it's one of the, I wanna say, first full implementations of this I've seen.
I've seen something like this, a screenshot conceptually around like Terraform tracing. I don't know, remember where that was. But so he's actually implemented something like this.
Yeah, he says he did something with a provider and called into the Terraform stuff in the chat. We're waiting all the on the full write-up. But historically, his projects have been awesome in the past, so I very much look forward to the full write-up. And I thought I should just mention it since you were mentioning, like, seeing how long stuff takes to get created.
Oh yeah, this is I mean, very similar, but this is far superior. This would be pretty awesome.
No, this is just open telemetry.
Yeah.
So he's showing it.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. So this is just the native open telemetry. Why? Awesome. He's just getting the data out of it into open telemetry. Yeah.
Yeah. So you could have that in Datadog or in whatever provider you're using.
Supports that. Yeah.
Well, a provider that's open telemetry compatible.
Mm-hmm. We can use X-ray.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. Then another small little utility. There's been a lot of these little utilities coming out over the last few months. Here's another one. Adds the ability to easily select some resources that you want to delete the state with. Often helpful if you are targeting some part of your infrastructure that you want Terraform to recreate. Obviously, you should have probably deleted that resource outside of Terraform if you don't want a conflict for some things. Last one was something shared in office hours by Alex Atkinson last call. I didn't see it, but it looked actually kind of cool. So if I got it correct, you're hitting the GitHub API to search for repos matching a particular string, but that was just based on our conversation. I actually don't see where this is searching other than listing repos.
Yeah, so that one, last call, we mentioned the deprecation of some of those features, save state and set output.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so what you can do is you can go in there and use this script to count for an organization, a specific organization. Say you belong to Nike. You can grab all their repos, clone them all at once into whatever directory you're in, and then this just, well, the comment down below then just looks for those deprecation flags in the workflow directory and outputs a fancy list. You can send it off to those repo owners and say, hey, go take care of your business or your products aren't going to work next week.
All right, cool. So it's actually in the response data when you hit the API for a given repo, whether it has it's affected by deprecations?
It's not. This, it depends on, so the first part of it is just getting all of the organization's repos. Like, that's all it's doing. It's going in and it's getting the clone URL. And then it just iterates that and says, you know, clone these 200 repos for Nike. But then the second part, the bonus comment, is going in and looking for the dependency.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So in the end, you still have to write your own little script to grep for what you, what was deprecated. I gotcha. And
that's just an example, but you could take out save state or set up and put anything you want in there.
Makes me think of the git x args command. which kind of formalizes some of that. I don't know if this can be used just for without opening pull requests. Matt, do you know if this can be used also?
You can run whatever command you want.
And not also open a pull request. I guess if you don't change anything, the pull request would be open.
Yeah. I think that's correct. Yeah.
I like that, but as much as I like the look of something, I really know Bash. And I can get
none in Bash. The devil you know.
Exactly.
All right. Well, that was a good... before we move on, any other announcements?
Two announcements I posted in the office hours and the Zoom chat.
All right.
The first one was Global Accelerator now supports terminating TCP for IPv6. I really, really like that AWS is investing in IPv6. I don't believe it's there yet, or at least it's not there for me. But a lot of governments and organizations have deadlines for IPv6 adoption. So AWS is investing a lot in that. And this one was something that was desired by a bunch of folks. So I'm happy to see it. Again, IPv6 is still not there in my opinion, but I like it. Like it's a step in that direction. And this to me.
That makes sense. Yeah. So ALBs have had that for a long time. So now, but I didn't realize that Global Accelerator didn't support IPv6. So now it does. Gotcha.
I think it supported IPv6 previously. This is just specifically the TCP termination, which speeds up things a lot. So your clients connect to the Global Accelerator and then that connection is terminated there. So the whole stuff, Global Accelerator talking to your endpoint is going to be faster. They say that in the second paragraph, and they are likely way more accurate than I, because I am terrible at networking.
Okay.
Is this just TCP stack tuning, like changing the default hang time from 60 seconds to 4 seconds if you're trying to run a big cluster? Is the same piece of work there?
I don't know enough to be able to comment on that. Sorry.
Matt, is that one of your up your alley as a networking master?
I'm really not sure, to be honest, on this one.
Yeah, I just know when you have 2,000 slaves in a Mesos cluster, it's been a while since I've had to do TCP tuning. But one of the problems we had was that when you have those connections open for 60 seconds, you can exhaust your TCP pool. And so you turn that way down to 2 seconds. Mm. Realistically, the traffic doesn't need to last that long when you're just running operations over it.
Oh, I got it. No, this is more, from my understanding, and keep in mind I am a huge dum-dum, this is more akin to the way Slack added CloudFront with zero TTL in front of their API just because CloudFront was doing TCP termination very, very close to the client. And thus, the whole run trip dropped by a lot.
Nice. So
the whole thing with Global Accelerator is that really, really close to customers. Terminating TCP there is going to reduce latency a lot. And this is the second announcement, is the formal announcement of the thing that was discovered that started happening on February 17 and people noticed, but it wasn't announced anywhere else except on Twitter, which was that EventBridge, it got a lot faster. I think, up to 80% faster than before, which is a huge deal and is enabling a bunch of workflows. So, February 17, we finally got the official AWS What's New announcement. I hate it when AWS releases stuff only on Twitter, and it drains my gears a lot. And I'm not leaking anything here because AWS, let me find the link. AWS publicly said this. There are more latency improvements. I posted the link in the Zoom chat thingy and now on Slack. Even more improvements are expected for sometime later this year. They might not become a thing, That's why AWS doesn't usually share expectation, but this is the PM query message. But yeah, so even more things are expected. This is nice. And since you're on Twitter, exactly, Luke, who was, I think, one of the first people to tweet about this, also, he's working at the Dutch post office. And this improvement in event bridge latency allowed them to do completely new things that they couldn't because they had to wait for so long. I can find a blog post if you want to.
I love it. 100 and whatever milliseconds is way better than 500 milliseconds.
Yeah, that's a significant difference.
Considering that's part of the proc time, like not even talking about public internet transit, like that's huge. You could do real-time bidding on that now.
All right.
There Although is actually a link also from Luke. He had a project by Say Serverless where he actually benchmarked latency for all the messaging services. And you can see them here. It's really, really awesome for when you're architecting.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I found it interesting that he used P50, the 50th percentile, as his measure there, though, which is in all those stats that was being shown.
I don't get the, can you highlight the significance of why that's interesting or not?
Well, it's saying like those are percentages. So that's saying like 50% of the transactions finish in that speed or less, where like the yeah. P90th or 95th would be like 90% or 95%.
No, so you've never seen an SLA say P50. Like that's not a good idea.
Yeah, I was just saying it was an interesting measure. It's usually like, it's either usually 90, 95, or 99 or something like that. They're using a much higher measure to look at.
Okay. And on a side, Luke did share P50 in his first post. He did share P90 and P99 improvements after.
I see it now, yeah. I was starting like my comment before I saw this.
No, it's a legit point, though. People do misuse statistics and do P's very often.
Last one was maybe not an announcement, but a tool that you used. Going back to the previous one on iterating over a GitHub org and fetching things quickly, clone entire orgs, user repositories in one directory.
Yeah. So actually, Eric, if you look in chat, I posted a one-liner how I clone every repo in an org.
In the Slack chat?
No, in Zoom chat, sorry.
Oh, there it is. Yeah. Okay.
So assuming you're in a directory that starts with the name of the organization, just run that and it will clone every repo in the organization.
That's very
I don't understand why people write large applications to do a function like that unless it has other features.
Yeah.
Unix philosophy is get the list, pipe it, run the commit.
Right.
I use that in cron to make sure I have all the cloud posse repos on my machine, like every day kind of thing, just so I don't never have to go clone a new one when we create a new one.
You're our human backup. Cool. All right, let's get into some Q&A then. Matt Gowie, I don't know if you're on the line. We talked about this question last week, but you weren't on. Doesn't look like we have Matt Gowie here today too. So we'll skip that. Jonathan Yunus, are you still here? Yeah,
cool. I am.
Awesome. Well, let's get to your question, see what we can do. You have a question, not specifically Terraform related, but interested if anyone has recommendations on software for answering security certifications and answering security questionnaires. Let me pull up my Slack as well here for everyone else. Do you want to add some more context there? I think you said more in Slack.
Sure. We've gotten to cut through a couple of SOC 2 processes. We are currently OneTrust customers, used to be known as Tugboat Logic, but there just seem to be dozens of these companies out there that'll help you get through, you know, ISO 27001 or HIPAA or FedRAMP or what have you. And, you know, we've been through 2 years of doing SOC 2. I'm just kind of taking a look around at what else is available. And if anyone has platforms that they like, I'd like to hear about them.
Oh, I definitely like Tugboat. They're fantastic. And you're right, there's a lot of solutions out there. And the big difference that sets them apart from others, such as Vanta, is the breadth and depth of their knowledge pool that's available for informing their product. And not just the product as it is, but as it evolves. Because, you know, we all know this is all based on legislation pushed through Parliament or, you know, whatever country they've got. This is all laws and they change and evolve. And that's what those guys have, the huge pool of lawyers and other various talents that are involved in the industry actively and can walk into your meetings. And if you have a question, they can say, I've seen that. This is how litigators the folks responsible for the compliance for whatever that is.
Regulators.
Yes, the regulators. They have offices and officials that have different names everywhere, which is the hard part for me. That's the value that I found with them. And as far as enabling your interaction with, you know, B2B clients or even B2C, informing people that, hey, this is our security posture, they have tools for all of that. So that's my two cents.
I think that's great in theory. I've asked them questions like, you know, what application should be a part of our certification? And their answers are very often, I'll call them a little bit absolutist, all of your applications, which is very different from the guidance I get from other CPOs who've been through the process, who say, pick a dozen, pick two dozen, and just, you know, your really core apps. So I just have a slight concern following their advice sometimes, because they, some of the answers seem to come back as though money is no object.
Time is no object. We definitely want to shape the scope of our compliance efforts, because if it's absolutely everything, then you're training, you know, you're training the cleaning staff on security.
Yes, exactly. It's like ridiculous. Cleaning staff, please acknowledge update of the latest policy set.
No, but that's not valuable. And when you talk about, is it a checkbox on a form or is it an answer you're providing during an investigation into a breach? Like, you got to consider the differences there. Is it a checkbox? Does it mean anything? What is the evidence? Like, is it a practical value? What is the effort that you're putting against this point? And whether or not a checkbox exists for it, if you use a new technology, there may not be checkboxes aligned for it. If you get into trouble, they're still going to hang you. Like, you've got to answer the questions that haven't been asked yet. So just be smart about it and consider who can access the P2, the protected whatevers, and just, you know, you've got to make sure that you're comfortable with your own posture.
And you were speaking highly, was it Alex, of OneTrust, aka formerly known as Tugboat, or something else?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Tugboat software. They got gobbled up by OneTrust.
Okay.
Yeah, it's officially now called OneTrust Certification Automation, Cert Auto, but we all know it as FKA Tugboat.
FKA is for?
Formerly known as?
Oh, okay.
The artist formerly known as Tugboat Logic?
I understand. I got
that. That would be a good t-shirt.
So I noticed that some of the providers are now promising AI-based questionnaire answers. I don't know if that, we'll probably do a trial on one of those, two of those. But there do seem to be some advances in, you know, in the space. I'm just wondering if there are any other vendors that we should be looking at.
That sounds phenomenal. AI-based response.
I wouldn't like AI involved in this at all.
No.
It comes down
You might want AI to inform you of, hey, consider this, consider that. You wouldn't want it involved in there because you want very precise things. And if AI puts any word in there, like, for example, all of the compliances you mentioned in your question in the beginning, my organization has all of them. And we had something really simple. We have like container images that are ones we build ourselves, and we have ones we used to call third party, right? And we were told, change that word from third party to vendor, because if you say third party, auditor is going to grill you for an hour. If you say vendor, they'll move on. So you want to be really precise when you're having compliance required responses. You don't want, you know, vagueness or detected AI stuff to be writing it, maybe to inform.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and that's a good point. But I think AI, this comes down to prompting, it comes down to training, it comes down to evolving it. And couldn't this cut out 80% of the laborious part, and then you have a final pass by people who know what they're talking
about? Yeah, if define the type of AI, like GPT type AI, I wouldn't necessarily trust, but informed, machine learned, yes, for sure.
Domain specific domain
training. Yeah, for sure, yeah.
All right, should we move on to the next one, Jonathan? You had three questions.
Sure.
Cool, so you're asking, what's up with the Datadog metric, Kubernetes state node age? It doesn't report any logical units like seconds, minutes, and doesn't seem well-documented according to the Google. Anyone know how to interpret it?
So we thought we'd put together a dashboard that would be just a simple, how old are the nodes? Which turned out to be, our nodes are 1.1 million on average, and sometimes they're 300,000 on average. I got to tell you, that's not consistent with, like, even if you try to interpret it as like milliseconds they've been alive, which is a little stretch, it's not how many milliseconds they've been alive. It just seems like they've chosen some arbitrary weird unit somehow, and it's like a unitless measure or a relative measure. I'm just not sure how to correlate that to something simple like how many minutes or hours or days of these nodes live. And it's also weird because kubectl get nodes clearly lists these things out. It's not like it's rocket science to know how many seconds or minutes a node is alive.
My guess is it's just coming from the metric server, and whatever the metric server is using is what it's reporting, but I don't know off the top of my head what the metric server reports for nodes.
Yeah, and according to the documentation, in the actual repo, I'll post it right here. It says it's in seconds. So if you open that up,
our nodes are not a million seconds old. Pretty, can pretty well guarantee that.
Yeah, I got you. I'm just saying, like, the way they've documented it, it says that it's supposed to be in seconds, so maybe there's something else wrong.
Yep. Is it the sum of all the nodes that you're getting?
I averaged it, I maxed it, I mended it. I looked at all, I measured it via cluster, I measured it via node. It could be something odd, but I have not found a way to interpret it that it could truly be come up to seconds. I mean, I wish I could. That was seconds makes complete sense. Our nodes are not a million seconds old.
Which is not an extreme number though, like 11 days on average, but I'm guessing you're running under a day or around a day since it's largely spot instances.
Yep, exactly. It's, you know, so you can look at the kube control get nodes and see that, you know, the minimum time is, 5 minutes, 3 minutes. The maximum time is 2 days or something of that nature. So I just haven't been able to track down why we're, we do have some Fargate nodes, and there may be some data poisoning, if you will, a broader interpretation that includes the Fargate nodes in the cluster as well. I have not been able to track down why we're, why a million or 400,000 is a rational figure.
All right.
Investigation will continue. Just let someone may have run into that before.
Yep. No, I haven't run into that one. Sounds like it's probably easily explained once it's understood.
I'm sure there's some magic. Some magic.
All right, let's see. The next question was, finally, we had a situation where Carpenter stopped auto-scaling up or down. A bunch of host pods were present to our eyes. A surprising number of those pods. Soon as those were deleted, everything returned to normal. Good auto-scaling ideas. Isn't this related to another known issue in Carpenter that they were looking into? I remember it coming up on office hours and being posted by Jonathan as something he was waiting on.
Maybe. I hadn't connected those dots. But it was just very weird because we've had such good results with Carpenter, and then it suddenly stopped, and there was this weird look to the cluster, and just a very simple deletion later, everything's working perfectly again. This is the first time Carpenter has really fallen down for us.
I'm just seeing if I can pull up, find that issue where they, is it this one? Node repair. Yeah, I think this one was the one I was thinking of. I don't know if it's related. And it's still open. And what's the latest? Yeah, let me share this one. Maybe something to look into.
I'll have a read.
Cool. We have another few minutes. Anyone have questions? Any questions we can get answered today?
I dropped one in the bottom of the, it's in the bottom of the channel. I didn't see a thread going, so.
Okay, hold on. Yeah, get back into that channel. I went somewhere else.
Okay. Essentially, I may have asked this in a different way previously, but we use Terraform outputs for things like informing Helm values and stuff like that. And we're trying to do things in a more GitOps fashion. So we're not always running the Terraform output every time we want to generate Helm values. So I'm curious what other people are doing for caching that, like just dumping the JSON to Git or pushing out S3 or other patterns. Some people.
What are you using for Helm itself? Or how do you inject the values into Helm? Did you mention that? Or was I reading between the lines?
No, I mean, I asked a kind of related question last week on that. So right now, our Helm values are, the values are just are in Git. And then right now we're using, I'm trying to get away from Spinnaker, but right now we use Spinnaker, and Spinnaker just picks up the Helm values from Git. But because we are generating Helm values for a very large number of clusters, large number of services, over 1,000 unique instances of services, we've templated that. So basically we have a large number of Terraform roots. And so what we're doing, right, what we have been doing is every time you want to generate your Helm, you have to run the Terraform, which means you need access to that Terraform state, which we don't want to give everybody access to because Terraform state is dumb and can have secrets in it, right? And so that's security concerns about that. So what one of our team members just recently did is he started just, he wrapped in our Terragrunt that it saves the Terraform output as a post hook, and it saves that into Git. And then when people, then we can generate the Helm offline without needing access to Terraform. You just get it from the Terraform output cache. We're debating if that's the right pattern, or maybe you should push that to S3, or curious what other people have done. When you want to get certain things out of state from outputs, but you don't want to give everybody access to the state because the state might have secrets in it. That's our contention. And it's slow. Like if you need to go and run a Terraform init across 100 Terraform, it's slow as hell, right?
I think you have two very straightforward, nearly native solutions to this. One is, just have your Terraform, since this is your own Terraform code, I presume, just have your root modules instantiate the Kubernetes provider and write the config map, write the secrets directly to the cluster. Like,
no, these aren't secrets. The secrets, we do that for secrets. These aren't secrets.
Yeah, so we do it for config maps.
No, but config maps don't work for annotations.
Okay, gotcha. I understand.
Yeah, so we did go that route for a lot of stuff where it's all right, it's for pods and you can read secret refs or config map refs. We have done that for some of it, but then we were stuck that there are certain things that Helm needs for, it's like writing annotations, and those can't read from config maps. Right.
Is that a level lower than kind of Kubernetes?
Yeah. And we're doing Helm file template, right? We're to make sure thing, and the Helm file template happens offline without access to the cluster. That's the reason for trying to do some sort of caching of it.
And you mentioned that you were already looking into or considering Vals.
No, last week that came up in the chat. Vals was another thing we're looking at. Yeah,
somewhere else. This is also something Helm file supports natively, reading from SSM.
That's what I was going to suggest, param store.
Yeah, it seems like the first step is at least getting it into SSM, and then there's several ways of getting it out of SSM depending on your tooling. Yeah. But SSM gives you the permissions model that you would still want possibly to have, and a totally standards-based way of doing it, consistent across tools. Anything that can use the SDK can read SSM. You don't need the S3 state, which is also proprietary and specific to that. I don't know. I don't love the S3 idea, but...
There was one advantage of writing just the raw, like Terraform output JSON to a file, is that the thing that's calling to get that cache, if it's reading that raw JSON, so it's the exact format, we've not altered it, like put into SSM or some other format, could be a wrapper that basically says use the cache. If there's no cache, go get Terraform, because the resulting JSON is identical whether you're running Terraform or looking at the cache. So that's why we started to go that route. But I've been looking for an exact answer. I'm just curious what other people do, because we're experimenting with what's the right pattern for us.
But the caching route still doesn't sound great, because, well, if you get a cache miss, you still need full permissions. So it doesn't reduce the need to have full access to Terraform
stuff. Yeah, it would only be that would be used in the case of, that's true. It would be the way to update the cache, I guess. So it depends. Basically, the deeper story of this is my team's the SRE team. So we maintain the stage and prod environments, and we want to be able to give our engineers who access and things be able to generate their own. They own their services. They're in stage and prod. They don't have full access to them, right? So we want to give them the ability to generate configs for their stage and prod environments, so they can have access to the Terraform output.
Mm-hmm.
Without giving them access to the production environment and potentially revealing secrets and other stuff. That's one of the big drivers. So it's really trying to get to a GitOps model, having it offline. It doesn't mean everything has to be in Git. We could push it to SSM. Sorry, just talking through it. We're thinking through what the ideal model for it, and just curious how others have done that. Ours is a unique situation because we have a very large not super unique, but we have a large development team with like dozens of teams, all maintain their own services. So it gets a bit more complex, I guess.
Vlad also posted something in the channel as well.
Okay.
Yeah, but I can repeat it here for the recording. So SSM to event bridge. So you put the parameters in SSM. Note that this is different SSM parameters for different output values. Don't just shove everything into one SSM parameter. When that parameter is changed, you can trigger an event through event bridge. That event can go into an SQS in case there are issues and for port torrents, and then a Lambda actually reads the message of the SQS and creates a commit and pushes that to Git. And then you can do whatever automation you want to Git. It's a pattern that has been working great in the past. It's fine. Basically, you want everything in Git because you're doing GitOps, which is legit. So you have to somehow notify Git that, hey, this change also changes value in here. So you need to do a commit at some point. That you do that with a webhook, that you do that with a Lambda, that you do that with a GitHub action triggered through the API or whatever. You have to get that value in Git somehow. And the SSM to Lambda thing works fine. Like we haven't had many problems in the past, and it's an easy to understand pattern. But also keep in mind that GitOps is interesting in the sense that, yes, you want to get everything in Git, but Git also has its own issues and the way you work with that. And we are still discovering the ways of actually productizing GitOps.
What we've encountered is just that any